I am so happy to see everybody. Thanks for coming this morning. We've still got some cheap seats up here at the front. Let me move something here. Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. And hopefully we'll have a few more folks kind of dribble in, and that'll be good. This morning we're going to talk a little bit about some things that I hope you're going to find helpful. And this is going to be the session where we're going to talk a little bit about seeing less and less tunnel and hopefully more and more and more light in our walks with Jesus. And we are going to talk about the fine art of mentoring. For those of you that have just walked in, I kind of took a poll of the audience. Like I said, last night I realized that we had the first and last session, the one this morning and the one tomorrow morning, flip-flopped. And we really should be, probably to make this sequence work better, we probably should be doing the one on redefining success. And that's one where we talk about a lot of things going all the way back to the days of the Beach Boys coming forward. And I'm not going to be able to do that this morning because some of you, and by all rights, came in here expecting to talk about mentoring. So that's what we're going to do here. This is what I do think of sort of as a Cliff Notes visit. And again, maybe the rest of you don't want to admit this, but I will tell you, these little yellow and black books got me through school back when I was a kid. There's to this day still lots of times that I'll be 200 pages into a 300-page book, and I'm thinking to myself, well, Steve, I don't really want to know that much about this topic. I need some quick takeaways, some points that I can go forward with life on. So what we're going to do here as we visit today, this afternoon, and again tomorrow are these three things. These are our goals. Number one, I want to keep everything that we talk about in here very, very fast. You might have heard about the old guy. This guy was not a great dad. And his son had ended up in jail and was all bummed out. So he writes his son in jail, "Dear son, I am so sad. It is that time of the year when you and I used to plant the tomatoes together, but I'm an old man and I can't do it. And you're in jail and I'm so sad. Love, Dad." Well, about 2 days later, Dad gets a letter back from his kid in jail. "Dear Dad, don't dig up the garden. That's where I buried all the bodies." Well, sure enough, the FBI gets the letter. They come, swarm the old fellow's house, dig up everything, can't find anything, peck on the old fellow's door, apologize, and leave. 2 days later, Jake gets another letter from his son in jail. "Dear Dad, sorry I couldn't bring you there to help. I hope you enjoyed the garden. It was the best I could do in a hurry." Well, we're going to do this one in a hurry, cover as much territory as we can. Number two, I promise that we're going to keep this thing simple. Look, I come from the shallow end of the gene pool. I'm not a real smart guy. And as far as I'm concerned, if I have to complicate a crowbar to make something make sense, I just don't want to mess with it anymore. We're going to keep these things real basic and very simple, even though they build entire graduate studies around these. I'll tell you what I thought we might do. Here's what I want to communicate. About 90% of the stuff that really mess up our lives, whether it's conflict resolution, whether it is dealing with our mentoring, or understanding what success is, or something else we do in this called Brand You, where I take about 25 years that I spent running an ad agency, and I really kind of make the case that, you know, if God's kids, well, first off, if Procter & Gamble is going to spend, whatever, $30 quadrillion this year trying to sell us soap, maybe we ought to learn how to communicate our life message effectively to the people that God gives us to love and lead. But as we teach these things, people sometimes come to me and they say, "Steve, the problems are just so big, I don't know what to do with them." Well, I'll admit that problems these days are huge. But Christians, when we start to break them down to their component parts, and we start to look at the things that make up the problems, then we're frequently able to buy away at a problem and see it change in ways that some of us don't even think is possible right now. And I'll tell you what I wanted to do. I thought, just as for fun, just to kind of illustrate this, maybe what we could do is something here, and my goal here is to show you how simple something that looks complex can really be. I'll tell you what I need you guys to do. As fast as you can, write down a number between 1 and 1,000 on that sheet. Just any number. As fast as you can do it, give it to your buddy right next to you. His name is Thomas, apparently. Or maybe those are Tommy Hill figures with a full name on them. Okay. This way, and bro, could you just put a number down there too, please? Any number between 1 and 1,000. Thank you much. Very good. All right, now, I need a little bit of help with something. There is an envelope, and I don't want to touch this right now, but there's an envelope sitting right here. I need a volunteer. Somebody will come up here and just pick up the envelope and open it. Who wants to do that? All right, I'm going to invite you to do it. Come on up here. What is your name?
Choa.
Choa. Choa. Where are you from, Choa?
I'm Minnesota.
Minnesota? For how long? Well, I'm happy you're here. Take that, if you will, please, and open the envelope and pull the sheet of paper out of it, but don't show anybody what's on that sheet of paper. Now, while Charlie is doing that, I'm going to take this pad back here to somebody, and I found that ladies can usually add better than guys. Would you be good enough to add those three numbers up? And Charlie, go ahead and pull the piece of paper out as fast as you can, please. Now just hold that pad because I don't want to touch it. There is a number on this sheet of paper that Charlie is holding that I put in there before we started today. And that number is going to be exactly the same number that these three numbers added up to. Are you ready? Okay, sister, read out as loudly as you can. What did those three numbers add up to?
940.
940. Okay, show everybody what's on that sheet. Whoa. Thank you, brother. Appreciate you doing that. Now, the question is, maybe that looks a little bit impressive, but the question is, how did that happen? I promise you that when you see how we did this trick, everybody in here is going to say, well, duh, anybody can do that. I mean, anybody's got walking around since can do this one. It's simple. Well, that's my broader point. Folks, everything we're going to be talking about in these three sessions are simple things to do. And when we begin to learn the strategies, or in this case, we begin to learn the trick, then suddenly things that just seem overwhelming really become very manageable. And by the way, I want to show you how we did this later. Okay. Third thing that we're going to try to do in all of these visits is this. I want to reach all ages. And I tell people that normally when we talk about these things, we're trying to reach three groups of people. Those of us in here that are retired who really do need to get refired and finish strong. Those in here that are in our middle years that want to have marriages that last and kids who don't. And also what I call the 20-somethings. And by the way, I don't stand on precedent there. Anybody from the mid-teens all the way through your mid-30s, as far as I'm concerned, you are a 20-something. Because these are the people that in many ways today, I am convinced, have got the most potential and the most promise of virtually any group that we've ever had in this country. They have within themselves the seeds of greatness. And they could actually prove to be this nation's greatest generation. But I'm just going to tell you what I believe. I'm not a politically correct guy. This kind of shirt, you know. But I will tell you this. This generation, if it ever proves to be a great generation, has a long ways to go. The truth is, this is also the most coddled, confused, and corrupted generation that we have ever had in this nation's history. So here's the drill. I am not going to pander. I'm not going to pretend to be hip or cool because I am not. I'm 60 years old, and I'm combing my hair with a towel. I'm not hip. And I wouldn't know Lady Gaga if she showed up in a T-bone steak dress. I'm not that way. But here's the thing. Even though I may not know who today's players are, and even if I did, by next Tuesday, they're all going to be different. Even though I may not know all the players today, I will tell you that what we're going to talk about in this room today and tomorrow are going to be principles that are permanent, they are perpetual, and they are eternal. So, here's what we're going to do with this session. We're going to talk about how to do some things right so we don't have to pay our pallbearers to bury us, and so that we can really have a marriage that does last, and so that we can leave the woodpile a bit higher when we leave this world. This session is the one where I would like to share with you what I think are six very important keys, not an exhaustive list, but six very important keys to being successful at mentoring. Here's the theory. I really do believe that everyone in every church in this nation needs to either be a mentor or have a mentor or be doing both. That's my thesis. I believe that. I've come to this over the decades. And this is the session where I'd like to, like I said, share with you what I think are six important ways to do this. And we're just going to jump into this very quickly. Let me say this. I think top of the list is this. We need to understand that mentoring really comes with an understanding that as a mentor, we have got to lead by example. You cannot be credible as a mentor if you don't. And, you know, again, I was laying in bed last night thinking about this, and I think I'm ripping somebody else off pretty close if this isn't their exact words. But it was just kind of dawning on me. I was watching a film about atheism that I had on Netflix. I'm laying there thinking about this thing. I'm thinking, wow, atheism seems to be spreading. And I'm really wondering, is it possible that the biggest cause of atheism in our world today, could it be Christians who don't act like Christ. I'm really becoming more convicted of this all the time. So I will tell you that, in my judgment, if we're going to succeed as mentors, we've got to be people who lead by example. And these are people who attempt to practice what they preach. And by the way, the operative word here is attempt. None of us are going to hit this thing on all eight cylinders all the time. And if we fall for the devil's line that essentially says, hey, just wait till you get your own act together before you attempt to do anything for anyone else. Christians, we are never, if we wait for that, we are never going to be of any benefit to anybody else. There comes this time to really rethink where we've been and change some things. This means that if we're going to mentor effectively, we have got to be people who are quick to admit that we're fellow strugglers, that we're people who have all of our own bags and issues going on. But the curious thing about this is when we start to communicate this to the people that we're attempting to lead, in many cases, this becomes the most enabling part of our message. It's not so much the words we say or the principles that we promote. Sometimes it's simply helping that other person who already feels beat up and who already feels like they've failed. Helping that individual realize, hey, listen, you know, I'm a pretty badly messed up individual too. And you think back and you really draw some lines between what Jesus was teaching and what the Pharisees of the day were teaching. And that was the big difference. I mean, I seriously go back quite often and I look at the Pharisees in the New Testament. And you can't find too much wrong with their lifestyles. Matter of fact, they were probably, in some ways, more religious than we are. But again, if we leave it in the realm of being religious and don't take it into the realm of becoming relational with not only people but with our God, we're never going to get there. And it's when I start to just admit, you know, I've got all kinds of issues. Listen, this is difficult for me. Because the hard thing when I'm teaching this kind of material is if I'm going to be credible, I have to be honest. And I don't know any way to do this without giving some examples. And I will tell you that there have been a lot of times in these years when somebody would come to me with an issue and I was simply too small of a person to really say, hey, I know how you feel because I've been there. But a lot of times when I'd say, yeah, I understand how you feel, but I didn't go on to say the rest of that. I've been there. Folks, I can tell you that back in the late 1980s, I was going through serious depression. I mean, serious depression. I was running a large company in Nashville, and I can honestly remember walking out of staff meetings and closing the doors in my office and just standing there bawling like a baby. I can remember coming up to stop signs on my way in or back home from work and really, really not knowing what to do. I mean, I remember one particular thing. Man, if I turn left and just go 2,000 miles, I'll run into the Pacific Ocean. You know, those were the days. And thankfully, I finally, you know, paid attention to this, got some medication, and got through it. And in 1992, I ended up having 5 heart bypasses. And I was only 39 at that point. I'll tell you more about that later. But I did get off some medication at that point after the surgery. And I recall I came back to see my psychiatrist, and he said, Steve, you seem to be doing better. I said, yeah, I haven't been depressed at all. And they took me off all that medication you had me on. And he said, well, you're doing okay. I said, yeah. And I said, they took me off that old blood pressure stuff that I've been on for 15 years. And he said, whoa. He said, tell me about that. You never told me you were on that. And I forgot what it was. I told him, he said, well, Steve, about 2% of the population has serious depression on that medication. Why didn't you ever tell me? But the point is, I understand and I can honestly communicate with people because of that. And I think I owe it to them. You know, one of the lessons that we can take from the infomercial world, and by the way, there's not much good about the infomercial world. Anybody knows what I'm talking about is these 30-minute TV commercials that run all night long because they know that when you're in debt or when you need something or whatever, you can't sleep and you're up all night long, you know, changing channels, watching these stupid things. But there's a method to building an infomercial. They show the problem. Maybe this is some poor schmuck that doesn't have enough money to buy a tube of toothpaste. And his world's upside down. And then suddenly he goes to this guy's thing, he gets all these books and tapes, and he suddenly becomes like this real estate guru. And 3 weeks later, he's like a multimillionaire. And then he always comes on, and you're sure that this guy could not possibly have more than about a third grade education. And he says, you know, today because of those books and tapes, I'm a millionaire. And you're supposed to sit there, and by the way, there's a psychology to this. You're supposed to sit there and look at that and say, whoa, if that guy can do it, then I know that I can do it. Well, again, I'm not a big fan of infomercials, but I will tell you that that's sort of how it comes down to be an effective mentor. We've got to understand that we have to communicate with people at a level that they can appreciate and understand. And this does involve taking responsibility. Specifically, it involves taking personal responsibility. And I will tell you, I am no fan of Adam. You remember Adam leads off the Old Testament? Kind of, you know, top billing in the kids' storybooks and all that kind of stuff. I mean, we think, wow, Adam and Eve, they were so cool. Well, I'm not sure they were. I mean, think back. Was Adam much of a mentor? I mean, here he is. God's given him a perfect job, a perfect place to live, and he's given him a perfect wife. And essentially, all Adam has to do is just kind of tend to this and be a good mentor for Eve and behave himself. And all he has to do that is don't eat from the tree. Okay? That's all he's been told not to do. And of course, y'all know what happens. You know, and by the way, this is from the Steve Diggs Revised Version. I'm just going to keep it kind of quick. The bottom line is, Eve goes trucking off down the path, and Adam's not with her. He's not mentoring her. He's not being a friend to her. He's not with her. She goes down here. She finds that tree, and she pulls off the fruit and starts chomping down on it. A little while later, Adam comes walking down the path and says, "Hey, babe, what you doing?" And she says, "Oh, I'm having some fruit. It's pretty good. You want some?" And he says, "Don't mind if I do." He takes the fruit. He starts eating. And of course, you know the story. God comes, and he says, "What in this world are you doing?" And Adam, what does he do? What does he do? "Well, you know, the warning you gave me, God." That is not the way a mentor behaves. A mentor doesn't... First off, if Adam had been a true mentor, he would have hung out with Eve. And certainly if she'd gone down by herself and done that and he walked along and saw it, he said, "Oh, baby, we can't do like this. Please, put the fruit aside. Let's pray. Let's ask God to forgive us." But again, Adam was not much of a mentor. And I do want to digress a little bit from the broad scope for just a moment of mentoring and get a little bit more micro on it for just a second. Moms and dads, let me just tell you something. In my judgment, the most important mentoring that we will ever do will be as parents. And the truth is, every kid that I've ever known is born with standard equipment of a hypocrisy meter. And it's usually right here. You just pull up the little shirt, it's about where the belly button is. And that thing is just running like 25 hours every day, about 8 hours every week. Or about 8 days, I should say, every week. And it's recording everything that we're doing as parents. And I'm just simply saying, Mom and Dad, the most important mentoring we will ever do is with our kids. And we have got to understand the importance of setting the right kind of example with them. Here's an undeniable truth. Whatever a parent does with liberty, you can bet money your kid will one day do with license. There are parents all over this country who, when the kids were growing up, if they were all up late Saturday night, they didn't worry too much about getting to Sunday school. Or maybe if they were on the family vacation and church was 15, 20 miles away, they weren't going to drive over to do that. Well, what the parents may have done with liberty, now the kids are, you know, pretty much doing with license. I mean, the kids don't even darken the doors of the church anymore. They don't have a relationship with Jesus in many cases. There are parents all over this country who would give everything they've got to be able to roll back the hands and do that a little bit differently. Fact is this, you cannot cook a kid. I wish you could, but you can't. I mean, I wish kids came like in cake mix boxes. You poured them in a pan, added water, popped them in the oven, and out came the cake. That doesn't work that way. But here's what we can do. We can mentor our children. And Mom and Dad, this is a responsibility that starts with day one, and it goes all the way through. And if we've waited too long, I mean, if we've waited till they're in their teens, it's going to be a lot tougher. But we still have that mandate from God. By the way, anybody in here happen to know why God told Abraham to sacrifice Isaac when he was 12? Does anybody know? It was because God knew that if he waited till he was a teenager, it wouldn't be a sacrifice. Christians, I know it's tough as they get older. I know it is, but we've got to do it. Why is all this stuff important? Here's why it's important, parents, selfishly. Here's the deal. No parent is ever going to be any happier than your very most unhappy child. We've got four kids, 23, 26, 30, and 32. And thankfully, they're all devoted to Jesus. They could not be any happier about that. Mom and I have never spent a night worrying about them spiritually. But I can tell you something, even today, if one of them gets sick or one of them has an issue, or a financial thing comes up, or whatever. People always say, "Your kids have financial..." Well, you bet they do. I mean, Just because I teach this stuff doesn't mean that the kids don't experience some problems. But when they have a problem, mom and I are in the trenches with them emotionally until it's over. So I'm just saying, the best precautionary thing parents can do is mentor these kids right, so hopefully you don't go forward with a lot of issues. I would tell you that a second key to effective mentoring is to understand that mentoring and leadership are almost exactly the same thing. You see, all mentoring is, it's a certain type of leadership. But it's a special type because mentoring is a type of leadership that shows but never shoves, never pushes its way in on things. Essentially, you know, in the leadership training models, there are two ways to do leadership. There is the old power-driven leadership, which at its basis level is nothing more than slavery. I mean, you could argue that a slave master is a leader, but goodness. And we've always had people like this that are very bondage-driven, that want to be in control. This is what I call the old Bob Cratchit syndrome. Anybody here remember this bird? Yeah. Does anybody in here think that Bob Cratchit came to work on Christmas Day because he just liked to hang out with the boss? No. Bob Cratchit came to work because he was scared to death of this old bird. And folks, that's what I'm saying. That is power-driven leadership. That is not the good kind. The good kind is mentoring, which is inspirationally motivated leadership. It's the kind of leadership that helps the followers really get excited and see the benefits, the potentials. It's the leader who helps the individuals that we're leading catch the vision and see the big picture and understand the why instead of the fact that they just got to do something. Really, when you get right down to it, mentoring is not anything more than inspiration and example put together. When one of us can inspire somebody and then set the example, that is mentoring. And that's the kind of leadership that seems to go the distance in every study that I'm aware of. I really like John Quincy Adams and what he had to say. He said, "If your actions inspire others to dream more, learn more, do more, and become more, then you, my friend, are a leader." I would think that if today John Quincy was still around, he might say it this way. If your actions inspire others to dream more, learn more, do more, and become more, then you, my friend, are a mentor. That's what mentoring is really all about. Inspiring and showing others what the possibilities really are. Listen, I'm going to tell you a real fast story about the most famous person that you've never heard of, David Dorotort. David Dorotort was born in 1915 up in upstate New York. He was born into a family. He was an only child. He was born into a family. His mom and dad were good people. They were pro-American. They loved this country. And sadly, I wish I could, but I cannot tell you for sure whether they were Christians or not. I know that they had a high regard for God. I know that much for sure. In his growing up years, the family did not do very well financially. They traveled a lot. But in those experiences, David grew to love the American West. As a matter of fact, he became a big fan of the American pioneer, the American cowboy. So it wasn't surprising to people who knew him that by the 1940s, David had moved out to California, and he'd become a very well-known movie producer and script writer. As a matter of fact, he produced several major Western movies that had done very well. But David was increasingly being troubled by something that he was seeing everywhere. He was being troubled by actually the very movies he was making. He was realizing, hey, I'm making movies about gunslingers, about very amoral individuals, and I know for a fact that many of the people that came out to the American West 100, 150 years ago, these, not all of them, but many of these people were very, you know, well-based people. They were people in many cases who were devout Christians. Some of them actually went west to teach people about Jesus as missionaries. And he was becoming more and more troubled about this. Well, going into the mid-1950s, David sort of saw the handwriting on the wall. He realized that the new direction for entertainment was going to be in television. And he came up with an idea. He wanted to produce a Western that would help mentor the nation. He developed an idea, and after a few months, several months actually, of work on this thing, he brings it to the network executives. He said, "I want to do a cowboy show." And they said, "Great." He said, "Well, let me finish." He said, "I don't want to do a 30-minute show. I want to do a one-hour weekly show." And again, back then, all of the cowboy shows, every single one was a 30-minute show. It was shot in black and white. David wanted to do his one-hour show in color. And they said, "Well, why is that?" He said, "Well, you're shooting these shows, these cowboy shows on back lots here in L.A. for about $15,000, $20,000 an episode, and there's not much meat to them." He said, "I want to do something that's going to really present a morality play every single week. And what's more, I don't want to shoot them all here in Los Angeles. I want to go on location. I want to go up in the high Sierras and shoot things like movies. And they said, David, you're crazy. We're not going to give you the money for that. We can't afford it. So David went home and he regrouped. Came back a few months later and said, fellas, here's the thing. I will pay for a substantial part of this if you'll do the deal. And I said, hey, we can afford that. Yeah, we'll do it. So with that, in 1959, there was a new TV show born. Does anybody remember this? Dum-ba-da-dum. What was it? Yeah, Bonanza. And it was a story about these four guys right here. Ben Cartwright was named for David Dortort's father, Ben Dortort. And, of course, his three sons, they lived on this mythical ranch right outside of Virginia City at the Ponderosa. I'm going to tell you about an eye-opening afternoon that I had a few years ago. Actually, it was 15 years ago. This was in October of 1997. My son Joshua and I had gone out west to spend 2 or 3 weeks. In those days, I was still in the business world. I had a little bit of money, and I was thinking, well, that might be fun to open a dude ranch in Nashville, or near Nashville. And so we went out there to visit guest ranches around the west. We flew into Las Vegas because it was just cheaper to get in there, rented a car, and started driving around several states. We did this for 2 or 3 weeks. We got back into Vegas 2 or 3 days before our trip home. I am no fan of Las Vegas. I've done seminars there. There's some awfully good people, but I don't care for that city. So I said to Josh, how would you like to go to Los Angeles? And I'll take you to Disneyland. He said, hey, I'd like to do that. So we drive over to L.A. And I can still remember, this was that Saturday morning in October of 1997. Josh was still getting ready. I was already ready, and I was just sitting on the bed. And I found myself thinking about David Dortort. I was thinking, I wonder if that guy could still be alive. So I picked up the telephone directory. Well, for you younger guys, back in the old days, we used to have telephone directories that put numbers in. But anyways, I picked up this phone book, and I started looking through this thing. I looked in Los Angeles. There was no David Dortort. Looked in Beverly Hills. No David Dortort. Turned over to Bel Air, and right there under the D's was David Dortort. You know, so me being me, I just picked up the phone and dialed the number. This lady answered the phone, and I said, Mrs. Dortort? She said, yes. I said, Miss Dortort, if your husband is who I think he is, he's my hero, did your husband create a TV show called Bonanza? She said, well, yes, he did. Would you like to talk with him? Yeah! About a half a minute later, David Dortort was on the phone with me, and we just hit it off. And he said, Steve, why don't you and Josh come over to the house, and we'll visit? I said, well, I promised to take Josh to Disneyland. He says, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, well, we're going to go to church up in Van Nuys. And he said, well, great, come down to 405, cut across Sunset, come see us. So about 1 o'clock on that Sunday afternoon, Josh and I arrived at David Dortort's home. By that time, he was an old man, as you can see. He took us into this library of his where he had written episodes, if I recall correctly, for Perry Mason and for Lee Marvin, a bunch of people, you know. But we talked that afternoon about Bonanza. And he regaled us with all kinds of stories. But his point was this. His goal was to, in the course of that show, to mentor the nation, redefine the American cowboy, not as a bum, not as a drifter, not as a gunslinger, but in many cases as a good family man with real values. And through the course of that show, which ran for about 14 years, they covered topics that in those days nobody touched, about the sin of prejudice. And this was a time when people were talking about euthanasia, right? That's the older folks, right? And they did a whole episode on mercy killing. And again, I'm not saying that I agree with everything that was in every episode, but that was a TV show that held a high view of God and really did present a morality play every week. I like what David said. He said this. He said, we try to teach something about human values like faith and hope. By the way, think about how many Hollywood producers you can think of today who would say this. Ben Cartwright is a strong, understanding man of wide experience who inspires the warm, vibrant relationships that should exist in a good family. He has authority and wisdom, and we make no apology for that. That is the ground that Bonanza was born in. The goal was to come up along beside and show, but never, never shove. Third thing that wise mentors understand, if they're Christian mentors, and I would really debate the point if somebody told me that you could be an effective mentor without knowing Jesus. That's my opinion. But Christian mentors are people who have calloused knees. Does anybody in here recognize this guy? Anybody in here 200 years old? Okay, that's Pat Boone. Very quickly, let me just tell you a little bit about about Pat, for those of you that don't know anything about him. Pat and Shirley met one another in Nashville in about 1954. They were 18 years old. They got married in 55. They eloped. Now, Pat was a well-known singer in Nashville. He sang at things, but that was not the goal. The goal was Pat planned to become a preacher and a school teacher. Shirley wanted to become the community nurse. And the goal was that they would find a small town where she could, you know, help children as a nurse. He could teach them during the week and at the same time have them into the house for Bible studies and then bring them to church on Sundays. That was the goal. Their goal from the day that they met was to mentor others. Now, some of you in here that may remember the story know that that's not quite what happened. After Shirley and Pat got married in 55, they just boom, 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 had four little girls. And by the late 1950s, Pat had become one of the biggest entertainment stars in the world. They moved out to Los Angeles at that point. And over the next few years, Pat was literally everywhere. His records were going gold. He was on the cover of all the magazines. In the 1950s, Pat had a television program that had bigger audience share than any single TV show today does. I mean, he was the biggest thing on television for a while there on Thursday nights. In the late 1950s, Pat sold more records than anybody in the world except for Elvis. Now, this is sort of the background to this whole thing. And as many of you know, Pat and Shirley had some struggles. In the late 50s, especially the early 60s, they got into issues between themselves and had a lot of things going on. Pat made his share of mistakes, some things that he should not have been involved in, and he'll be quick to admit that today. But I will tell you this, even through the worst of it, that fire of wanting to mentor never went out. And Pat came back to the Lord, and so did Shirley in a beautiful, beautiful way. And I can tell you that to this very day, and by the way, Pat worked with us on the seminar and on the Stop Running on Empty book, but I can tell you that to this very day, unless that's Jesus, turn off your phones. I forgot to mention that. Pat and Shirley are a couple of the most dedicated mentors that I have ever known anywhere. Here's what I wanted to communicate. And maybe I shouldn't have popped this picture up quite yet. But back in the 1950s, get a picture here. Pat was born in 1934. So in 1957 and 8, this kid was, what, 25 years old? 23, something like that? Here's what was going on in his life. He was a huge star. He had a record deal. He was in the recording studios all the time, every time he could catch his breath. He had to be in New York every week, Thursday night, to do a live network TV show. Weekends, he was traveling, doing shows. He had a 7-picture deal with 20th Century Fox. And at the same time, he was taking a full load at Columbia University in New York, where he would graduate magna cum laude. Now, with all of that going on, this kid still felt like he needed to at least use the platform that he had been given to mentor. And in those days, he wrote this, did this book right here, Twinks 12 and 20. And this was before we had computers, remember. I mean, you type these things out. If you made a mistake, you erased and started over, okay? This was a book that became a bestseller, number one on the New York Times list, and touched literally millions and millions and millions of people. Through these years since, Pat and Shirley have continued to mentor. They funded the Boone Center for the Family at Pepperdine University. Shirley has her own ministry called We Win, where she teaches women how to mother and how to be great wives. But here's the thing that really impressed me, I guess, the most. I was out staying in their home for a few days working on this thing a ways back. This book stopped running on empty. But one of the things Pat was talking to me about, he said, Steve, you know, when you make your mistakes, when you commit sins, God will forgive you, but the consequences go on. He said, after I repented of my evil, he said, the 60s were wearing on. We were coming into the 70s, and we noticed that our girls were not coming back to Jesus. Matter of fact, we found that they were going to these parties, these all-night parties, because I had not been paying attention, with their friends, mixed boys and girls. And the parents would buy liquor, they would buy drugs, and then they'd move out of the house for the night. And this kind of stuff was going on. He said, of course, when we realized this, we put a stop to it. But he said, Steve, the truth is, we had to get them out of the environment. So we decided to start a family act. And that's in the 70s. You might remember that Pat and Shirley and the girls traveled. That was a big part of the reason, to get them out of that environment. On one of their trips home, Pat and Shirley found out that the girls were planning to sneak out to another one of these parties. And they just put their foot down and said, no, this is not going to happen. And, of course, it was a big, huge family blow-up. Everybody went to their separate corners. Pat and Shirley, when this thing, kind of thing happened, their way of dealing with it was to go upstairs to their bedroom and to get on those callous knees and start praying for their daughters. One of their daughters, during the time that they were doing this, came upstairs, she opened their door, and she looked inside, saw her parents on their knees with tears in their face, praying by noon for these girls. And she quietly closed the door and went around the house telling her sisters what she had seen. And Pat and Shirley will tell you to this day that that probably had a greater impact on changing that family than anything else they could do. Christians, if we're not going to spend time on our knees for the people that we love, we don't need to try to mentor. Fourth thing that wise mentors understand, by the way, what is our timeline? Do we have another 5 or 10 minutes? Or okay. Is it 10:40 right now? Okay. When are we supposed to stop? Does anybody know? Is it 10:45? Okay, I'll be out of here a lot quicker than that. Okay, first thing that the smart mentors understand is that to be a mentor, you've got to be there. You've got to invest the time. You know, it's like anything else that's worth doing. You've got to be available. I can remember 1968 and 69. I was a teenager growing up in East Tennessee. I could not wait to get to David Lipscomb College in Nashville in 1970. My goal, and by the way, that's a Christian college in Nashville. My goal was simple. I wanted to meet a professor there that I'd heard about for years and years. I admired this guy. He was a well-known preacher, and I thought, man, this is going to be my mentor. Again, I didn't even know the word then, but that was what I was expecting. I recall getting to school. I took all of his classes. I set some appointments to come to his office and visit. He was always kind to me, but he was always too busy for me. I can remember him looking at his watch while we were talking and kind of tapping his fingers. Nothing ever happened. A few years later, after I was in the business world and after we'd begun our ad agency, I ran into another fellow, and I don't have his picture here, but I'll show it to you this afternoon, who was an elder in the Lord's church. He became one of my clients. His name was Alton Howard. Does anybody recognize that name? Anybody watch Duck Dynasty? Okay, Corey's parents, John and Chris Howard, are my contemporaries, dear friends, and it was John's dad. He was one of the elders at the Monroe, or the Whites Ferry Road Church of Christ that you see on that TV show. Alton, shoot, he could have bought and sold Bill Gates twice in a day's time with the change that fell out of the holes in his pockets, practically. He was a rich guy. He owned oil wells. He owned department stores, real estate. Matter of fact, he started a chain of stores, got tired of them, sold them to Sam Walton, and they're now what you call Sam's Wholesale Stores. Okay, this guy had tons of stuff going on. He became one of my clients. But he also had big wings, and he put me under one of his wings, and he was always available. I can remember times when in the middle of the night, things would be upside down in my world. I could call out, and he'd say, "Hey, Steve, why don't you get on an airplane? Come on down here to Monroe." And I'd come down there and stay at his house. I can remember sitting up with him one night at his house until 3 or 4 in the morning talking about a problem. And I finally got so tired, I just went to bed. Next morning, I come down to the breakfast table, and there he sits with a yellow pad where he sat up, I guess, the rest of the night, writing out what he thought I should do. Folks, that's a mentor, a person who has the time and the availability. One of the things that I did write as a dad were the midnight runs. We homeschooled our kids, so we had a little more flexibility. But one of the things that I always enjoyed doing was coming into one of the kids' bedrooms at 10 or 12 o'clock at night, waking them up and saying, "Hey, you want to go on a midnight run?" And they knew what I was talking about. They pulled their clothes on, and we'd get in the car or on the back of the motorcycle, and we'd go down to McDonald's or to the Krispy Kreme or something. They thought we were going out for health food. We were actually simply going out so I could talk and get to know the kids better. And to this very day, they still talk about it. Our 26-year-old daughter is a school teacher. A few weeks ago, I called her and said, "Hey, Emily, what are you doing?" It's about midnight. She said, "What are you doing?" She said, "I'm about to go to bed, Dad." I said, "Hey, you want to go on a midnight run?" She said, "I'll be outside in 15 minutes. I swung by her apartment, and we went on one. Parents, you can't invest too much. Successful mentors understand that it is not about power. It's not about pushing somebody and kicking somebody around. It is about presence, being involved in their lives. And dads, I can't say this one strongly enough. This does mean you. I am personally persuaded that when God's guys really start to act like God's men and start to grow some spiritual spines, that we're going to have a far lower number of radical feminists and confused kids and homes that are in a mess. I believe that. And I think we need to get on our game. One of the things that I talk to, in especially men's retreats around the country, is about manning up. We have got to learn to do this. And also, men, I'm also kind of slow about some of that because men today in our culture are getting beaten up right and left. You think about it. Anytime, can anybody here think of a TV commercial that's on the air right now that has a man and a woman in it where they're pitted against each other on any level, where the woman doesn't come out ahead and the guy doesn't end up looking like a doofus? See, that's our culture, and we have to rethink some of this. One of the things I really love about Shirley was her heart. Shirley did something that was very good, very right. Back after Pat had gotten serious about the Lord again, he still traveled way too much. I mean, he would go on 6- and 8-week trips sometimes to Japan. But what Shirley did, and ladies, this is something that you can do. You can hold up a man even if he's not on his game the way he should be. There were lots of times that the girls would come to Shirley and they'd say, "Mom, can we do this or do that?" And she would evoke Pat's name. "Well, what do you think Daddy would want us to do? Or why don't we call Dad after the show tonight? Let's talk to him." Keep the guy in the loop. Very important. Folks, the world tells us a lot of lies. The world says, "Hey, you can have it all." Not true. You cannot have it all. Period. Life is nothing more than a series of choices. The losers are the people who never figure that one out. The winners are the few people who finally learn to say no to the nice and yes to things that are vital. Number five, fifth thing, all of the successful mentors that I've ever known are people who motivate with what I like to call possibility thinking. That is not my phrase, but it is a good one. It's this idea that if we're going to mentor, we need to be motivated to mentor. And if we're not enthusiastic, then the better thing to do is just to get real quiet, crawl into a corner, and not even claim to be a Christian, not even claim to have a message. Because if we're not enthusiastic, you know, others aren't going to be either. Finally, last thing we're going to talk about here on mentoring is this. All of the mentors that I've ever known who have succeeded are people who themselves have core values. We talk about politicians in office even today that don't seem to have core values. And we talk about religious leaders who don't seem to have core values. And we talk about people in business everywhere who seem to understand the bottom line, but they don't understand what morality is all about. These are the things that we stand on. These are the principles we believe in, the hills that we're willing to die on. Listen, real quickly as we wrap this up, let me just share with you the story of some famous Wilsons. Woodrow is one that's pretty well known. Woodrow Wilson, one of our presidents, but not generally thought of as having been a great mentor. There was a mentor right down the street from Dennis, Mr. Wilson. Not a great mentor either. However, you remember Tim Allen, his next-door neighbor, Wilson? He was a pretty good mentor, wasn't he? And what about Tom Hanks? You remember Tom in the Castaway movie? He had a little Wilson in his life. Now, the trouble is we don't know much about that Wilson. Didn't have a great personality. But what I want to do real quickly here is I want to tell you a last story about another Wilson. That's, unfortunately, the only picture I have of this guy when he was a little boy. Wilson was born in 1911 in Illinois. He was born into a family with a brother. His mom, bless her heart, she was a woman of God. His dad was a drunk. His dad was did more damage to the family than he did good. But oh, his mama, she loved Jesus, and she made it her business to put those boys on her lap and teach them about Jesus. She was also the most popular Bible school teacher in that part of the state, for that matter. They went to church across the river right here at the First Christian Church of Dixon, Illinois. And by the way, she was the most popular teacher there, but at age 12, 1922, that's where Wilson was baptized by immersion for the remission of his sins. By age 15, he was helping his mama teach Bible classes there. At age 18, he went downstate to a Christian college. But on the weekends, he would come home, and he would help his mother teach about Jesus. We don't hear too much more about Wilson for a few years, but then in the 1940s, he pops up again. And by that time, Ronald Wilson Reagan has dropped his middle name. And he's the guy that we know of in the movies. I want to just read something to you from the book. I can read it better than I can say it, and we're going to wrap up with this. Decades before he became a 40th president, Ronald Reagan had mentored America on the core values of righteousness and justice. So it came as no surprise that he brought those same core values with him into the White House. Now, over the years, President Reagan had forged a true friendship with Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev of the Soviet Union. He did this to surmount what generations had grown to believe was inevitable, either at best a stagnant Cold War or at worst nuclear annihilation. Well, as all good mentors know, there comes a moment in time when truth must be spoken, when their core values have to be seen. And that's exactly what happened on June the 12th, 1987, near the end of his presidency, when Reagan confronted communism head on. Everything that day was on the line, and despite what some uninformed observers might have thought, what President Reagan said was not spoken rashly. Lower-level diplomats had discussed a lasting peace, but everybody knew that it was going to require one person, a person with core values, to do the deal. This was calculated. Today was the day. And on this day in 1987, President Reagan, standing in front of the Brandenburg Gate, delivered a 2,700-word speech. This was the culmination of all that Reagan had worked and prayed for through his life. President Reagan concluded that statement, that speech, with this statement: "Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Well, now everybody knew where Reagan's core values were. A lot of his advisors were quaking in their Gucci's about now. A year later, what was going on? Well, at their final summit in 1988, the Russians treated Reagan like a celebrity. At Gorbachev's personal invitation, Reagan gave a speech at Moscow University. And how did all of this happen? Well, as Paul Harvey used to say, here's the rest of the story. It boiled down to Reagan's personal core values. Reagan did not stroll up in front of those international microphones on that particular day and unexpectedly challenge Gorbachev. Based on James Mann's book, The Rebellion of Ronald Reagan, and some recently declassified papers at the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley, I am now convinced that Reagan had spent years building a bridge to the Soviet leader. He had exposed his soul to Gorbachev. He began this mentoring process way back in 1985 at their very first summit meeting. Reagan went into that meeting determined to discuss his faith in Jesus. He had heard Gorbachev use the phrase, "God bless," which he hoped might indicate a deeper faith on Gorbachev's part. According to the note takers that were present at that meeting, the President of the United States of America attempted to persuade Gorbachev that God existed. Gorbachev was so touched by Reagan's openness that, to everyone's surprise, he said, "I myself, Mr. President, was one day baptized." The conversation then suddenly turned to religious tolerance in Russia. Reagan saw his opportunity, and he suggested that Gorbachev allow people to practice their faith openly. What were the results? Well, the results, they speak for themselves. Churches that had been boarded for over 70 years reopened their doors. And along with thousands and thousands of other Americans, I was privileged to go into Russia on a number of occasions, into their colleges and their churches, and even one casino, to teach about Jesus. Here's the thing, folks. Two facts, one question, and a challenge. We're out of here. Fact number one: everybody in this room is getting older with every day that passes. Everybody knows what their age is, right? That's when everything either leaks, drags, or sags, right? They say, "What kind of underwear do you wear? Boxers or briefs?" And you have to say, "Depends." Old age is coming. And if you live long enough, fact number two, we're all going to get old. So here's the question: what are we going to do with our old age and our experience? Are we going to be reservoirs, or are we going to be rivers that pass it on? Here is the challenge. Little girl got in the car one day with her daddy. She was 6 years old. Driving down the road, the windows are down. A bee flies in, starts flying around the windshield. She is allergic to bee stings. She says, "Daddy, daddy, there's a bee." And without even thinking about it, her daddy puts his hand up on that windshield and cuts the bee. The bee stings, and he pulls back his hand. And the bee starts to fly again. And she says, "Daddy, the bee's loose." And her daddy looks at her and says, "Baby, baby, it's all right. Daddy's got the stinger." Christians, there's a bunch of us in here this morning who have a lot of stingers. Only question is, what are we going to do with them? This afternoon at 4 o'clock, we're going to get back. We're going to talk about how to get right in the money, how to get it, give it, and grow it, 8 keys to a worry-free money life. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about how to redefine success, and I think you're going to like that by far the best if you can get back with us. Real quickly, let me just tell you, we've got some copies of No Debt, No Sweat and Stop Running on Empty. Those are $20 and $26 books. We also have the CDs of the seminars, both seminars, Retooled and No Debt. Here's the reason I'm mentioning this, because we don't do this over here at the gate, but if anybody's interested, I've got at least a few of the CDs I know out here. You can get either book you want for $12, either set of CDs, which are $35 sets, for $15, or if you choose to get one of each, you get a book and a CD. I'm sorry. Well, a book and a CD for $22. Just see me out here if you're interested. We're out of here.